British Prime Minister Keir Starmer traveling to the White House.
You would expect Sir Keir Starmer to try and strike up some sort of US-UK trade deal.
It will be a meeting of two men who don't necessarily share one view.
The most important meeting between a British Prime Minister and an American President since the Second World War.
Power comes in many forms. Most obvious, the political power wielded by elected presidents or prime ministers. But there is another kind of power. Just watch this.
This is a letter from His Majesty the King. It's an invitation for a second state visit. This is really special. This has never happened before. This is unprecedented.
Laying it on with a trowel, isn't he?
This is a very special letter.
The King is being used to flatter the American president.
That is really nice.
Because the British government wants to flatter the American president in the hope they'll get a decent deal out of him.
So that's quite a signature, isn't it?
Donald Trump obviously falls over backwards when the royal family is mentioned. If Starmer came and invited Trump to Britain, he'd have shrugged it off. The fact it's the King appeals to Trump's vanity. There's a kind of mysticism about monarchy, and that's what I'm fascinated by.
Good morning, everybody. This is the real center of today's events.
I seem to have been reporting on the monarchy forever.
This is David Dimbleby.
On lavish weddings.
We're going to be paying tribute to Diana, Princess of Wales.
Traumatic funerals and all kinds of national occasions.
Join us tonight on BBC One.
In all these events, the BBC have been, if you like, the royal ringmasters.
Could you just be the bride, please, and walk out of the abbey?
Helping the monarchy display itself as it wants to be seen.
The lighting is all cock-eyed at the moment.
Are you pro-monarchy, Mr. Dimbleby?
Well, I'm pro-television series about the monarchy. They are at the centre of our national life. And I'm not suggesting that's going to change anytime soon. But personally, my view is that there are important questions to ask about monarchy, as the late Queen herself admitted.
No institution should expect to be free from the scrutiny of those who give it their loyalty and support, not to mention those who don't.
So, I'm going to take her at her word.
I've never talked about any of this before in my life, but I hope it all led me into very bad ways.
All those things would have been discussed with the Queen. Hang on, this is hypocrisy.
You are a Dimbleby before you start attacking inherited privilege.
What power do they have?
If people knew the levels of power and influence, they would really question it.
What exactly makes them qualified to run a country like this?
Do they earn their privilege?
It degrades us as a society to say that anybody is born better than anybody else.
Prince Andrew will now be known as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor.
And to what lengths will they go to survive?
A day to remember.
It's the ultimate soap, isn't it?
In a world descending into chaos, with volatile leaders disrupting the old order, what role is there for our unelected head of state? Or to put it quite bluntly, what's the monarchy for?
God save the King!
God save the King!
This is the moment when the UK says thank you to Her Majesty, who is out on the balcony of Buckingham Palace. What a moment.
The House of Windsor, the world's most famous family, descendants of a line that's reigned for centuries. Queen Elizabeth II, for seven decades a symbol of stability and restraint. The more opinionated Prince Charles, waiting to be king. His wife, Camilla, for years a source of controversy. William and his wife, Kate, hoping to embody 21st century Britain. And their son, George, already being groomed for kingship. Just imagine for a moment that a complete outsider, let's say a Martian, came down to Earth and saw all this display. There'd be no question in their mind about it. It would be perfectly obvious. This monarch must be the most powerful person in the kingdom. And then you discover, as you look a bit closer, that she's more like the wizard in The Wizard of Oz. She's not the ruler of Britain. But what is she then? Why is she there? And how much power does she actually have? In the past, monarchs used to start wars, execute their enemies, and steal their lands.
Sir Keir Starmer, Your Majesty.
Your Majesty.
Now, of course, it's the Prime Minister who makes the big decisions, and the monarch is meant to remain neutral. They do meet once a week, but what passes between them is a closely guarded secret.
Good evening, Your Majesty.
You've had a very long day.
There was one Prime Minister who said, it's an occasion for me to talk to someone who's as well-briefed as I am on what's going on and is not after my job. I was effectively the Queen's senior advisor. Certainly in my time, Tony Blair felt this was an important part of his week.
Another very busy day.
Yes, it has been, because we were preparing for the European Council.
Of course, that's Thursday.
Why does the monarch need to know what's going on?
Well, she's the head of state, and you can argue that she shouldn't be, but she is, and she does receive all of the intelligence reports, receives all the diplomatic communiques, she gets reports from all over the world, from the Commonwealth and from our allies, and gets a daily report on what's going on in Parliament. She has a red box, same as a minister, so she occupies a role within our government.
And you don't object to that?
Well, I would suppose the argument in favour of it would be that it, as head of state, she needs to be fully informed about what the state is up to.
National Canine Defence League.
I didn't know much about them, and I couldn't find out a bit more if you thought it would be worth it.
That'd be an excellent idea.
I can understand the politicians having lots to say. I mean, don't they always? But from the Queen's point of view, what did she have to offer?
I don't know, because no Prime Minister has spoken about the audiences, and no private secretary has spoken about the audiences, and I'm not going to start now.
Can you tell me about the very first audience of the Queen that you had when you were appointed Prime Minister?
You feel nervous because, I mean, it's this extraordinary moment that you've sort of dreamt about. You get into a car and, you know, you've driven up the Mall and you'll go into the gates and into Buckingham Palace, and it's a moment of great pride and great emotion. It became such a feature of your week. Trip up the Mall, walk up the stairs, don't trip over the corkies, wait in the waiting room, chatting to the private secretary, going in, bowing and all the rest of it, sitting down, and then the procession.
Maybe they never say anything.
Just sat there.
Prime ministers tend to have no one who they can confide in, because they're at the top of a particularly sort of backbiting and poisonous tree, and there is no one who they can go in and say, oh, everyone's ghastly. You've no idea how difficult it is to be me. And then the sovereign says, well, yes, it's a terribly difficult job. I sympathise. And it may be just that. It may be half an hour therapy, really.
I mean, it's like a sort of therapy session with the world's greatest public servant. Because you're trying to explain to someone who is extremely experienced and has literally heard it all before, the challenge of answering the questions sort of helped you to clarify sometimes in your mind what the real problem was.
I don't quite get that. I mean, you have a cabinet, you've talked to them, you talk to your ministers, you talk to your civil servants and all that. You've been in Parliament answering questions. Yeah. And then you come to meet the Queen and you come away, oof, I'm resolved to do really well on this issue. I mean, it sounds rather weird. You're Prime Minister.
I don't think it's weird at all. I mean, there's something special about the conversation with your monarch. You know, they are... You know, there's no one else in the room. There's nobody listening. There are no minutes. Nothing ever leaks. It's sort of, it's a special conversation. And it helped me, I found, just clarify what I was thinking and what I was trying to do.
Even if you don't agree on policies?
Well, you never knew what she really, she protected her impartiality and being above politics, you know, religiously. So you'd never really get a feeling.
But you must have an indication of when you're talking to a person in private, whether they're looking at you in a steely way.
All I would say is she was very careful not to express an opinion.
No, that's different,
yes,
though.
Yes.
But you can tell whether what you're saying is being happily received or unhappily received.
Yes.
Did you?
I'm not going to answer that.
You can always tell by the questions people ask what they think.
You can think. You think you can. But you don't always mean, it doesn't always mean you're right.
This EU referendum, Prime Minister, are you sure it's a good idea?
Are you asking me whether I think
no,
it was a good idea
I'm
or.
Queen.
Yeah, well, you know, even an actor of your distinction is not capable of that, so I'm sorry.
But what exactly is impartiality? And does it mean never, ever expressing an opinion?
The sovereign has the right to be consulted, the right to encourage, the right to warn. Every reshuffle, for example, has to be approved by the sovereign before it's announced.
But you're talking fiction now, because, I mean, there's no way that the sovereign's going to say, no, you can't make so-and-so Home Secretary.
It's not fiction in that it does happen. So what I'm recounting to you is completely accurate.
You seriously mean that the monarch is a check on government?
Yes. I've seen it. I've seen it multiple times
really?
in evidence, yes.
So we'll have a vote on whether to stay in the EU. All those things would have been discussed with the Queen?
Oh, unquestionably.
Would she have any influence on the decisions?
Well, that's...
I mean, can we now say the Queen was in favour of this and in favour of that because the Prime Minister of the day did it?
Well, the sovereign of the day has a right to be consulted, right to encourage, a right to warn, but very, very importantly, the Prime Minister of the day has a right to say, thank you very much, but I'm going to pursue a different path.
As a historian, I think that is shocking, really. It's like a whole part of our political narrative is sort of missing. What really is the working relationship between Downing Street and the palace? How significant is the monarch in a sort of on a sort of daily basis? Are those prime ministerial audiences just a nice cup of tea? Or actually are they more significant than that?
It's most extraordinary, isn't it?
What were the conversations? What was the planning? What was the meetings? What was the brief? What was the agendas? Don't you want to know that?
Your Majesty, Prime Minister.
The issue here is that one person has access at a much higher level with more influence and impact than anyone else in the land.
The moment I've been dreading.
And of course, this is not just about king or the queen, you know, so we don't want a future monarch in however many decades' time deciding that they've got a really important issue they care about and then lobby about it.
We're all behind you. The country is behind you.
If for 70 years his mother was a model of neutrality, how will Charles choose to reign?
as Prime Minister, I had a number of meetings with Prince Charles. But then towards the end of my premiership, they were starting to think about how he would do audiences with a Prime Minister. And so I was asked, well, would you be happy to go and do an audience with Prince Charles as well as the audience you do with Her Majesty the Queen? I said, yes, of course, I'd be delighted to do that. And it was fascinating to sort of be the, as it were, almost the guinea pig in his thinking about how he'd do the job.
When you were doing this rehearsal of what it's like to be king, did he express any opinions or did he just listen to you?
The Prince of Wales, I think he's allowed to have opinions and views and challenge and question. And I remember saying, I know absolutely the difference between that and then when you're monarch and you have to take a step above those issues.
But will Charles find it possible to stay above the issues? Judging by his time as king in waiting, it may not be that easy.
His Royal Highness, Prince of Wales.
There's still an enormous number of areas which need a great deal of attention.
Young Prince Charles is a man with strong opinions.
A great deal of destructiveness has taken place in terms of throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
He doesn't just want to sit there and do nothing, cut the odd ribbon, have a cup of tea. He travels widely, talks to people from all corners of Britain.
Yes, of course, yes, I do my very best.
And he thinks of himself as giving an ear to those who feel ignored by politicians.
I've seen a lot, and I've been very touched by the way people have, you know, responded.
He begins to carve out a role for himself as unofficial spokesman for all kinds of issues.
It's just that I feel that certain things have to be said, and if you skirt round the issues all the time, how do we ever get anywhere in life? Do you know what I mean?
And Charles doesn't just talk about what he thinks.
I write a lot. You know, that is a very, I find, therapeutic exercise.
He writes over 2,000 letters a year, many to people at the heart of government.
Well, I was working as a special advisor in government, and I just had a recollection of one of these missives from then Prince Charles coming in. And I remember it being treated as though it was some sort of a holy writ. I mean, it wasn't quite on a silken pillow, but almost, and put to the top of the red box. And I just remember thinking at the time that it's astonishing. No one else, you know, whether it was a hospital or a major piece of public work or another minister even, would be treated in quite that same way.
If he had something to say, it's important that ministers should know about it. There is nothing on God's earth that says that he shouldn't.
Except he gets the privilege that no other citizen has of being on the top of the letters in the red box.
Yeah, well, fair enough.
Is it?
Yeah.
He wrote private letters. I don't think that's unreasonable.
Really?
No, I think that's perfectly proper.
Perfectly proper.
Perfectly proper. Well, we must assume that ministers are completely spineless. That if you have a government policy you want to push through, it doesn't matter if you get a letter from the Pope, you're still not going to change your policy.
Don't forget, this is not the occasional note dashed off. This is a sort of sustained industrial level over many, many years. It's an incredible weight of influence being brought to bear. And if the other letters that were sent over all these decades were treated in the same way as the one that I saw, then the suspicion must be that the minister paid immediate attention to them and may well then have, you know, changed their diaries or changed their minds as a result.
Supposing instead of writing memos, when he next met the minister, said, look, it's really dreadful in Bradford, what's going on. I think you ought to look at it. Would you object to that, or would that be reasonable?
I think that is reasonable, because that is just part of his role, advising.
So hang on. So what's the difference between saying, minister, I think you ought to have a look at what's happening in Bradford, well, and writing a letter saying, look, have a look at what's happening in Bradford?
Because I think the example you give would be a one-off example of, I experienced this, and I think you ought to know this, Secretary of State, compared to industrial-level lobbying around particular issues that one person has felt to be very important.
And, I mean, is he meant to be shtum?
just go around something?
Well, up to a point, yes, actually. But I just think it raises important questions about how we're governed and how ministers work and access to decision-making from people that deserve to be heard.
Did you come at all years ago?
I came just before I was leader.
Yeah. It was always known that Charles would sound off on his favourite subjects, but no one knew what he actually wrote, nor whether he had any influence. In 2005, under the Freedom of Information Act, a group of journalists asked to see what the heir to the throne was saying. Their requests eventually landed on the desk of Attorney General Dominic Grieve, who read the letters they'd asked for and decided not to publish them.
When I looked at the letters, it was clear to me that there was nothing in the letters that was were remotely improper. What he was doing was communicating with government ministers in confidence about matters which had been raised with him or which he had seen in the course of his public duties.
But why if he was just doing a job that he was entitled to do, why shouldn't they be published?
In exactly the same way that there would be no publication if I, as a government minister, wrote a letter to another government minister.
But it sounds as though you think that the King and the Prince of Wales are entitled to interfere in government.
Not
to say what they think, to advocate.
Well,
why don't you do this? Why don't you do that?
They are.
And in a democracy, we're not allowed to know what they're saying.
Well, in a democracy, you're not allowed to know what ministers are saying to each other.
Yeah, but we can throw them out.
You can throw them out. But at the same time, if you want to have the benefit of experience and advice being fed into government, it has to be in confidence. It may well be that you can interpret from those letters his own personal views. I think that's correct. And they are views which he would not wish to express in public.
Why?
Because of the need to maintain neutrality, public neutrality. But that doesn't...
Hang on. This is hypocrisy.
No, it's not.
You maintain neutrality in public, but in private, you say what you think to a minister and expect them to jump through the hoop.
There's no expectation in those letters of people jumping through the hoop.
But nevertheless, you thought publication would undermine his position of neutrality.
Yes,
it seems to me what you're saying there is he's not actually neutral, and publication would reveal that.
No.
Well, really?
No.
For an unbelievable 10 years, the government had fought a legal battle to prevent the letters being published. It went to and fro, and finally ended up here in the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court has ruled that a series of letters written by Prince Charles to government ministers in 2004 and 2005 can be made public.
As for Clarence House here, they say they're disappointed that the principle of privacy has not been upheld.
I was working for Charles at that time. 7 years by then that I'd been in the royal household. I can tell you, he felt quite sanguine about it. I mean, he definitely believed in the principle of privacy. He said at some point, one has to draw the line.
Good morning, sir. Are you worried about these letters? Are you still writing to ministers letters like that? Have you not been behaving unconstitutionally by writing letters like that?
So why didn't he say, I'm not going to fight this? Let them publish.
It wasn't his battle to fight. It was Cabinet Office versus Guardian newspapers. And it all went on in the background. It rumbled on for 10 years.
You meant that through all that time, he was saying, well, why the hell didn't they just publish it?
No, the point for him was the principle of privacy. But he won the media war because nearly every single newspaper and broadcaster reported that the letters were a damp squib. They said nothing out of the ordinary and nothing that was unexpected of Charles or that he hadn't previously said before.
I disagree. When you read these letters, they're based on very strong convictions and a good deal of knowledge about what he's talking about. I mean, just to take one example, the 8th of September 2004, the Prince of Wales writes to the Prime Minister about a tea party that he'd had for Cherie and Tony in Scotland. And he says, it's a great pleasure to meet you for tea. I thought it might be helpful if, as usual, I put them in writing. Support for beef farmers. Sufficient support for hill farmers. A sense of anxiety that the Treasury will try to stop this. Something to be done about markets. The government must encourage people to buy British. The Ministry of Defence must buy more beef. I did raise an entirely different subject. It must have been quite a tea party, this. These Lynx helicopters, they're very poor in high temperatures. They're not working properly in Iraq, and we must do something about that too. Yours ever, Charles. It actually looks like Mary. And the Prime Minister doesn't say in reply, just thank you for the cup of tea. He writes back a month later, thank you very much for your letter. As ever, I found your points constructive and thought-provoking. And Dullard, I much enjoyed your speech the other day on climate change. Yours ever, Tony. So what do these letters tell us? They don't tell us that Prince Charles, as Prince of Wales, was able to influence government policy. But it does tell us that he was determined to do so if he could.
I was opposed to those letters coming out. I didn't see why they had to. I thought that was, you know...
But they expressed very strong opinions about things, and they were put at the top of the red box, so they took up ministerial time, and that was the objection to it.
It doesn't bother me at all.
Really?
No.
I mean, if I wrote a letter, it wouldn't go to the top of the red box.
Yeah, but you're not the Prince of Wales.
I'm sure there's plenty of ministers in Tony Blair's cabinet who thought that Charles was a little bit irritating. But his letters are written in a terribly polite and humble way.
It doesn't mean they're not powerful.
That's true. I would agree with that. I'm not, you know, naive. If you receive a letter with a crest on the back, then your office might bring it to higher prominence.
Of all the issues Charles gets obsessed by, one of the front runners has always been architecture.
The Prince of Wales says we could make mankind feel grand again if we built our cities better.
He spent decades lobbying relentlessly against the modern in favour of the traditional.
There is no need for buildings just because they house computers and word processors to look like machines themselves.
Here he is saying exactly what he thinks in a 1988 documentary he made with the BBC.
Just look at this out-of-scale monster.
And here he is again, this time complaining about a planned extension to the National Gallery in London.
What is proposed seems to me like a monstrous carbuncle on the face of a much-loved elegant frame.
The design was scrapped.
Many architects were furious when he called this building a 1930s wireless.
But Charles was unstoppable.
My problem is that I have an inherited inability to keep my mouth shut.
His critics portray him as an unelected, meddlesome prince who has too much power.
In 2009, he went so far as to reach out to some royal friends to intervene in a proposed housing development he didn't like.
The prince wrote to the royal family of Qatar, who own the site, calling the project unsuitable.
Following Charles's actions, the original design for more than 600 new homes was scaled back.
You'd think by now people must have some idea what I'm trying to do or not.
I'm sure he still writes to ministers now. I'm sure he does. In one way, why shouldn't he?
Charles always claimed that when he became king, he would stop this kind of lobbying. Although when he was asked about it in a film to mark his 60th birthday, he didn't sound quite so sure.
Would you be able to go on championing big themes?
I don't know. Probably not.
Charles knows he has to say that, that as king he'll be above politics. But the interesting thing is he actually doing it? Just have a look at this. This is the court circular for February the 10th, 2025, the official record
of the king's engagements. The king this afternoon visited the Duchy of Cornwall's Nansleden development in Newquay. His Majesty viewed site plans at the Orchard Cafe, went on foot to the community kitchen, when eating charity staff, walked around, met residents, da-da-da-da-da. The one thing it doesn't mention here is the people with him.
The King has taken the Prime Minister and Deputy Prime Minister on a day trip out to Cornwall to visit a sustainable community supported by the Royal Family's charities.
Highly unusual to see, well, not just the King and the Prime Minister together, but also the Deputy too.
Yeah, normally we might see them at big national moments of commemoration, but this doesn't happen very often. And I think if you want a sign of how the King is trying to do things differently during his reign, this is certainly one of them.
We've looked into it, and it seems Buckingham Palace can't come up with any other instance where a reigning monarch has actually been on an official visit with both a Prime Minister and Deputy.
He justifies the influence he has, the letters he writes, the people he talks to, by saying, oh, I go around the country and I meet a lot of people and I hear a lot of things, and it would be remiss of me not to pass on those concerns, which, in my view, is completely spurious argument. There is absolutely no reason why his views should be listened to any more than anyone else's. But there is no doubt that he has the access.
Absolutely.
Where are the lines now? What can he speak about? Or is he just literally going to be like, you know, shaking people's hands and just sort of doing this sort of royal walkabout pleasantries?
We nearly call this series What's a King For? What is a king for?
Gosh. Well, historically, of course, he was the font of all power, a figure of authority, a figure of justice, a figure of stability. And then over time, gradually, the monarch had to accept Parliament having more and more power and significance.
Unlike most countries, we don't have a written constitution. Instead, we're governed by what's called precedent. That's to say, just long-established practice rather than laws, saying who does what. And one of the last powers left to a monarch is to summon or dismiss Parliament. It's often said this was to make sure prime ministers couldn't declare Parliament open or closed for business to suit themselves. At least, that was the theory. After Britain voted to leave the European Union, this supposed power of the monarch was put to the test.
Several thousand people had gathered in Whitehall, many to voice their opposition to a no-deal Brexit or leaving the EU.
Stop Brexit!
Parliament simply couldn't agree on the terms for our leaving the EU.
So you were in the middle of the Brexit brouhaha. The Conservatives didn't have a majority in the House of Commons. So you had a government that was not in control in the House of Commons.
You are not children in the playground. You are legislators.
Amid the chaos, the new Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, and his team have an idea. They'll silence their critics by simply shutting down or proroguing Parliament.
Prorogation, it was something that I, as Leader of the House, was aware was something that could be used to get back control of the House of Commons.
Mr. Dominic Grieve. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
what I picked up were rumours coming from reliable sources who were really concerned about the impropriety of what he was doing.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
As leader of the opposition, I felt what Johnson was doing was wrong and unconstitutional.
The Prime Minister.
He wanted to extend the recess ad nauseam so that he wasn't under any pressure over Brexit negotiations.
Mr. Speaker, with permission, I shall make a statement on the mission of this new Conservative government.
Much easier not to have Parliament around, because Parliament could express disagreement, could ultimately, of course, bring a vote of no confidence in him. None of those things are possible when Parliament isn't sitting.
In order to suspend Parliament, the government needs sign-off from the Queen. So Johnson sends a team to her Scottish home, Balmoral.
By the time we land, the news has leaked, and there is an emergency cabinet meeting.
An emergency meeting of cabinet called at short notice.
There was no good reason to suspend a parliament apart from his desire not to be bothered by a House of Commons that might be rebellious.
But his line was that there was nothing left for parliament to do.
Well, that's nonsense. It's plainly nonsense. What he's saying is, I'd like a period with no accountability to you.
The royal household makes things run very smoothly. So, greeted by Queen's Private Secretary, you're given coffee, you're looked after, and then you wait until the Queen is ready. The old corgi was there listening in. So the Queen was pushing, and it was quite funny seeing one sovereign having to deal with a recalcitrant dog.
So then what happens?
What happens, there is a list of business, and the Queen says one of two things. She says approved or referred.
The Prime Minister would have consulted his Attorney General.
Yes.
He said, yes, go ahead.
Yes.
What happens on the palace side? Surely somebody there says, well, this is a bit rum. We'd better consult somebody about it.
Yes, yes, that would happen.
Normally, the connections between Downing Street and Buckingham Palace, the constant conversations, would have sorted that out in advance. Why didn't they?
There's only so many times that people can say, are you sure, and get an answer, yes. We re-asked the Prime Minister and he is sure. And then the decision was made. The Queen said approved. That was the approval for the prorogation.
So in the last few minutes, the Queen has given her permission to suspend Parliament.
If you shut down in Parliament!
Demonstrations are taking place everywhere because people are angered and outraged at what is happening.
I thought it was improper. It was grossly improper.
What does improper mean?
To attempt to govern without without accountability to the Commons for a lengthy period in the middle of a political crisis is an unconstitutional act.
If it was unconstitutional, why, when these councillors went to see the Queen, did she say yes?
It would have been, in my view, difficult, if not impossible, for her to not grant the prorogation.
But hang on. It's her one power.
No, it's not. Modern constitutional principle is that the sovereign acts on the advice of the Prime Minister.
You mean the Queen had absolutely no alternative but to say yes?
But she could have said no, but I think that
would have... What do you mean when you say she could have said no?
Well, she could have refused to do it, but then she could refuse to pass a bill passed by Parliament. It doesn't happen.
All the constitutional experts say she did not have a choice in the matter. She could only have said yes.
So what's the point in asking her if she can only say yes?
Oh, good question. One of the mysteries of our constitution, David.
I think that she felt that she would be seen as being too political. She was then faced with a choice. Do I go with the Prime Minister, or do I go with
what is predominantly opposition MPs. There were some Tories who agreed with us, but not very many, who have this view.
Over the next few weeks, there were legal challenges to the decision to prorogue Parliament. And for the second time in just over 4 years, issues affecting the monarchy ended up in the Supreme Court.
The court is bound to conclude that the decision to advise Her Majesty to prorogue Parliament was unlawful because it had the effect of frustrating or preventing the ability of Parliament to carry out its constitutional functions without reasonable justification.
The Queen seemed to make the wrong decision. She agreed to Boris Johnson proroguing Parliament and then had the Supreme Court say it was wrong to do that.
Yes.
It was illegal.
Yes.
Of course, she didn't know it was illegal at the time.
But it did look like a right royal cock-up, didn't it, when it happened? It's sort of slap in the face for the Queen, apart from for Boris Johnson.
It was really uncomfortable. It was a very uncomfortable time.
This is the most modern, vivid example of monarch and parliament, and the monarch being called upon to exercise the, you know, residual rights that they have. And in a way, she didn't perform the function of monarchy at that point. And so what does that show? That ultimately, parliament absolutely called the shots.
So when push comes to shove, the sovereign serves the government of the day. And that brings us to a different kind of power the monarch exerts on their behalf. So-called soft power.
The Royal Yacht Britannia bringing the Queen to New Zealand.
30 million people are waiting a royal occasion.
The city centre came to a stop as the royal party ambled up Auckland's main shopping street.
Throughout her reign, the late Queen was flown around the world at the behest of successive governments to smile, to shake hands, and to make small talk with countless foreign leaders and dignitaries.
It is an awful lot of abroad.
President Bush and thousands of guests have welcomed the Queen to Washington.
And here in Britain, she hosted over 100 state visits, sometimes forced to entertain tyrants like Mugabe, no doubt through gritted teeth, or the odious Ceausescu of Romania. She's not doing this because she wants to. In fact, when she saw him walking in the garden in Buckingham Palace, it said she actually hid behind the bushes to avoid having to talk to him. She's doing it because the Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, had been told by Ceausescu that a state visit was the condition for his doing a trade deal with Britain. That's soft power, wielded by the sovereign. Sound familiar?
This is a letter from His Majesty the King. It's an invitation for a second state visit.
Of course, there are moments when soft power can be used to great effect, to try to heal the wounds inflicted by history.
Well, Her Majesty has just touched down at Baldonnell Airport. These are the live pictures as the plane comes to a halt.
Well, I think we were all anxious about how this visit would be perceived. It was going to make a big splash, we knew that, but it had to fall right.
It's the first time a British monarch has ever visited the Republic of Ireland.
Strong security, like nothing seen here before.
There was huge anticipation and a lot of secrecy as well, because there were still, you know, massive sensitivities about the British sovereign on Irish soil.
The last time a monarch came here, the Republic didn't exist. When the Queen's grandfather, George V, visited in 1911, Ireland had long ago been colonised, forced to become part of Britain. A bloody war of independence followed, and a British sovereign would not have been made welcome.
I remember the first day there was not quite a funereal silence, but it was almost a signal, almost saying we're reserving judgment. We're waiting, we're watching, we're going to see how this goes.
The Queen and her husband, Prince Philip, boarded a bomb-proof, bulletproof Range Rover loaned by the police in Northern Ireland for her trip into town.
We sat in the back of the car everywhere we went. We talked about our kids. We talked about all sorts of things. And she was very relaxed. I never got the impression from her that there was an ounce of nervousness. We had a big dinner in Dublin Castle. And the argument then was, and I had put it very strongly, that I felt that she should say a few words in Irish. In the 19th century, the British government had done all in its power to really to wreck the Irish language in order to really impose its will on the people. But I felt that if she just said something in Irish, that that could reach into hearts that were pretty hard and soften them. Our people in Dublin were, oh my God, no, you can't be doing that. Now, what if she got it wrong? And Irish is notoriously difficult. The last I knew was that Her Majesty would not use any Irish language in the speech. I was happy enough with that, to be honest.
Aoctiroin. Argus.
I was in the room at the time, and I remember the Irish president at the time, Mary McAleese, was sitting next to the Queen, and she just said, wow, wow.
I literally almost fell out of my seat. I looked straight across, and I was looking at Edward Young, who winked at me and then laughed, and I knew the laugh was to tell me, we got you.
I don't think I've ever winked. I wouldn't presume to wink at her. Is that what the former president of Ireland said?
Mary says
perhaps she's right.
Historic, symbolic, words much used, but an accurate description of this event's significance.
And that created the stepping stone, which a year later, in June the following year, allowed Her Majesty the Queen to make history.
On the final day of her visit to Northern Ireland, the Queen inspected a theatre in Belfast.
In previous royal visits to Northern Ireland, there had been vociferous opposition from those who wanted a united Ireland. But over the past 30 years, the two sides had finally been reconciled and were now represented by their two political leaders, Republican and Unionist. The man on the left, Martin McGuinness, had been a commander in the IRA, the people who had killed the Queen's cousin.
Earl Mountbatten murdered by a remote control IRA bomb.
Shaking hands with McGuinness can't have been easy, but it was a masterstroke of soft power.
I think the most important thing was that the representative of what was empire and colony to us would come to make amends. But I also think it was important that it was her, because she had been queen as the empire slowly, slowly disintegrated.
I think it was a real moment and speaks to the soft power of monarchy and of the Queen especially. She was theoretically above politics, intrinsically woven into politics, but above the grubbiness of politics.
And
the monarch is a very important part of Britain's soft power and ability to build relations with other countries.
Would it have been different if we'd had a president?
So I don't think a president... If you had an elected president, there'd probably be a political figure in some way, and people would be looking, well, what's the political edge? Why are they doing this? Which party do they support? What's, you know, there'd be all those questions.
Well, I think an elected president has a lot of influence at home. But in the world that we live in, kings and queens and princes and princesses still, you know, hold the Hello Magazine spot when it comes to, you know, celebrity.
And why is that?
It's history, isn't it? We still have the big, big, big overhang of colony and empire and power and majesty. And there is still a kind of mystique, isn't there?
Of course, not everyone buys into the mystique of monarchy or its power to do good. There are those who think Britain should ditch the king and elect a head of state instead. They tend to come out on days like today, when they know the royals are going to be on parade.
Hello and welcome to Commonwealth Day, which is always one of the most vibrant and uplifting days in the calendar of this historic building.
We know from polling that republicanism is more popular than ever before. But it's fair to say it's still a minority cause.
These people are nutters, right?
They're nutters.
Extremists.
I'm making a film about the monarchy, so I'm in the position of objectivity.
I hope you are. And I hope you expose how successful.
But why do you think these are all nutters?
Because they're a tiny minority, aren't they? We have 65 million people in the UK, and there's only what 30 here with the same yellow flags.
I say out, you say no.
This guy's famous as a liberal lefty. It's a false
liberal lefty.
Lefty, typical. You mix in white privileged circles.
So you mean I shouldn't be here?
You should be here, but make sure it's objective, okay?
I'll do my best.
So, with objectivity in mind, what do the people here believe?
Why Commonwealth Day?
Well,
it's usually a fairly benign organisation of...
Well, it's less to do with the Commonwealth and more to do with the royals who turn up, and it's an opportunity to protest against the monarchy.
What do you got against them?
Against them, personally, not a whole lot, other than the fact that if there were a free and fair election, they wouldn't win. And yet there they are, and so they have that arrogance and presumption to be in that position without any kind of self-awareness.
The existence of the royal family is intrinsically harmful to this country and to the freedom of the people of the country.
In what way?
They symbolise a class system, they symbolise feudalism, and they symbolise so many things that are harmful about this country.
Yeah, I think, you know, they're just the top aristocrats in the country. What exactly makes them qualified to run a country like this?
I don't believe in bloodline superiority. That is a belief which is incompatible with the existence of monarchy. Now, I know that I hold political opinions which are a minority in this country, including republicanism. It's not a majority belief in this country, and I'm fine with that. But I think that there are many more people, including supporters of the monarchy, who, when they think about the idea that anybody from the royal family is born better over every other child that was born in this country, I think that may bother them just a bit.
Is the monarchy at the apex of the British class system, or has British class virtually vanished apart from the monarchy?
Has British class vanished? Your surname is Dimbleby. I mean, it clearly hasn't.
But it's not an inherited job. It's not like the monarchy.
It's not an inherited job, and yet the surname may well do some heavy lifting.
No, no, think? No. It's inherited talent.
Sure.
wealth, privilege, and power. It is what the monarchy is. I wasn't a monarchist going into the palace. I grew up in Bridgend in South Wales. It's not particularly fertile ground for pro-monarchy. But this somehow works. I think it does a job of being more things to more people than an elected head of state ever could be.
There's something sort of deeply irrational about our constitution, which allows an individual, purely through dint of birth, no other reason of merit or anything else, to have this incredible influence and impact on the way we're governed. Prime ministers come and go, but the monarch is there for as long as they live, influencing weekly the prime minister just because of who they were born to.
The precise power of monarchy is hard to pin down. What goes on behind closed doors is shrouded in secrecy. We know they have no real power under the Constitution, not even, it seems, to stop actions by our politicians that turn out to be unlawful. We know they have soft power, but that's at the service of the government of the day. But I think it would be naive to argue that with their constant access, particularly to prime ministers, they have no influence at all over what gets done.
If people knew the truth of the levels of power and influence, they would really question it. Because the only way the monarchy works is everybody either being apathetic or being feeling very affectionate towards it. If those bonds are broken, then there is really no purpose and point of monarchy.
There's much more we don't know about monarchy, but perhaps we should.
The whole question of money was something that we always had to be extremely sensitive about.
Moderation in all things.
That is a huge amount flowing into the private pockets of the royal family.
Well, I had quite a few conversations with the Queen about it.
And did she purr with pleasure when you explained how it would work?
And what lengths will they go to survive?
If you're born into this position, you have a duty to behave.
Andrew seems to have been the Queen's weak point.
Unbecoming. He was a sex offender.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm being polite. And in the sense that he was a sex offender.